Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone, to The Andrew Lawton Show and a very special edition of the program this afternoon as we have invited the field of leadership candidates for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario to a live in-studio debate. We've moved the studio, but it is still in studio. We are streaming live on 980cfpl.ca, on the airwaves at 980cfpl, and if you'd like to watch this event in all its spectacular glory on the 980cfpl Facebook page as well as on the global network across Ontario. Three of the four candidates in the field very graciously agreed to join us this afternoon. They are Tanya Granick-Allen, who is the president of Parents as First Educators, Doug Ford, who is the former Toronto City Councillor and mayoral candidate, and Christine Elliott, the former MPP and Ontario Patient Ombudsman. All of you, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
So to give you a bit of a rundown for the candidates and those tuning in to the ground rules for today, the debate will be moderated by me, Andrew Lawton. All of the questions have been seen only by some of the debate organizers and none of the candidates. They're a combination of questions that I myself have come up with and those that have been submitted by listeners from across the region in Ontario. As the voting for the leadership starts tomorrow, this will be the last opportunity that the candidates have to discuss and engage on these issues in this format. And we are going to not focus on strict timelines on specific answers, but rather a general timing for the debate itself. So our team will be keeping a running tally of how long the candidates have been speaking. If one of you is dominating, I will graciously interject. If one of you keeps dominating, it might be less gracious, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. And more importantly, the candidates are encouraged to challenge each other, but we, of course, request order as we'd perhaps a little bit better than we see in Queen's Park, but order nonetheless. And at the end, they'll have the opportunity for closing statements. Because we are in the heart of southwestern Ontario, and this is a very unique event to southwestern Ontario, I wanted to focus on issues that really pertain to this region in some of them. And the first question, by order of random drawing, we'll start with Tanya Granick-Allen. Tanya, employment in the London area ticked upward into 2018, but the jobless rate did rise in January. We've seen, though, in the broader region, the manufacturing sector take a huge decline. Do you think it's a sector that still has a positive future? And as leader and eventually premier, how will you help it get there?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here, Andrew. Some people don't know, but I'm actually an alumna from the University of Western Ontario, and I spent several years here and actually worked at the building I can see through the window at One London Place for a period of time. So I have understanding of some issues that affect London. With respect to ways we can bring economy back, the jobs back to London, of course, I was very pleased to see that Dr. Etker was going to be expanding their plant here. Obviously, I was, you know, it's sad that the factory in New Brunswick closed, but, you know, that'll bring a little bit of a boost to the job sector here in London. One area that I think that gets overlooked from time to time is actually the agri-food sector. And that's something that I think Ontario needs to invest in and put more energy, can I say in general energy, in towards that sector. But of course, we can't talk about bringing back manufacturing or increasing manufacturing in Ontario without discussing the crippling hydro rates. And having high hydro rates in Ontario and in London, that scares businesses from coming and making those investments in Ontario. So until we tackle those high hydro rates, we will not be able to be attractive to manufacturing in Ontario.
Thank you. Doug Ford.
Well, thanks for having me here, Andrew. Andrew, you're looking at the St. Thomas plant. They closed the Cami plant. To answer your question, yes, we can bring manufacturing jobs back to Ontario. You see what's happening south of the border right now. Trillions of dollars are coming into the country, lowest unemployment in 20 years. Manufacturing plants are coming back to the U.S. We can do the same here, but we have to create the environment to create jobs. I always say government doesn't create jobs. They create the environment to create jobs. We have to give these companies some tax incentives. And don't mistake that from corporate welfare, because I'm dead against corporate welfare. But it starts off with, number one, making sure we don't have a carbon tax, making sure that we have affordable hydro rates. We have the highest hydro rates in North America. That carbon tax is a job killer. It puts us at a disadvantage competing against other companies around the world and companies south of the border. As you saw, the Cami plant's going down to Mexico. Well, we need to start attracting companies up here by giving them incentives, giving them a reason to be here in Ontario, and getting rid of the carbon tax, giving them incentives, and making sure we have low hydro rates. We have the greatest people in the world right here, living in Ontario, living in London. They just need the opportunity.
Thank you, Doug. Christine Elliott.
Well, thank you very much for having us here with you today, Andrew. It's great to be here because I had asked the party whether we could have another debate in Northern Ontario and Southwestern Ontario, so it didn't work out that way. So it's great that you're doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm also a very proud Western graduate, and it's great to be back here. I know that London has suffered some crippling losses of large businesses that have left. I do think that there is a provision for manufacturing to come back, but we have to settle the conditions to make it such that businesses want to locate here. First is the hydro rates that my colleagues have already discussed. We need to deal with that by repealing the Green Energy Act and the multi-fit contracts that were signed for values that were far in excess of the value of the energy that was being produced. We also need to work with business owners who feel that they're under attack from the Wynn Liberals. Mm-hmm. They feel that with the dramatic increase in the minimum wage and some of the other provisions under Bill 148, it's really not an atmosphere that's conducive to business. So we need to work on that. No carbon taxes. We all agree on that. I think that there are other things that we can do, but I think that manufacturing in the large scale that we used to have probably won't happen, but we really need to use innovation across the board and really look at what we can do with a well-educated workforce to spur people on to promote entrepreneurial spirit and to make sure that the businesses that they bring forward can actually stay here in Ontario. It's not happening right now due to, in part, a lack of venture capital, but we need to make sure that those businesses can stay here and not go to the UK or the US as they are.
I know Doug touched on this a little bit in his answer, but all of you, can you give a specific example in this region, in southwestern Ontario, of a plant closure from the last 5 years or a decade that you feel, if you were the head of government, would have been preventable and how you would have gone about that?
Well, in this region, I'm familiar with the closure of the auto plant in St. Thomas. So that, I think, again, with auto and manufacturing, it's the hydro rates. And that's why I've been very clear all along. I did not wait till I ran for leader to say that I'm going to scrap the cap and trade and get rid of the carbon tax. But also, more importantly, I'm going to rip those wind turbines out of the ground. That would bring instant relief to Ontarians and to manufacturing in Ontario to reduce those hydro rates. Until we tackle the hydro rates, no manufacturer will see Ontario as an interesting place to do business, as an attractive place to do business. So we need to deal with that day one. It has to happen. So we, as Ontarians in the business sector and as taxpayers, receive that relief immediately.
But is there a specific closure that you think would have been preventable, that you would have prevented as premier?
Well, I mean, I mentioned that one example, but I know Doug did. So that's just one I have. I mean, I think the McCormick Spice Plant, I believe, did that close as well?
No, that actually
that is still
recently.
Going. Okay, my apologies, but
McCormick's Candy Factory.
Oh,
did.
I apologize, but sorry. I mean, when I was at Western, I know 3M mm-hmm. was as a big contributor in London Life and whatnot. But again, until we're tackling those high hydro rates, it doesn't matter. We're going to be losing businesses because they're simply going to find a cheaper place to do business. And Ontario right now is not that place.
You did give examples, Doug, but more specifically, if you were the premier, how could you have prevented that or prevent similar ones?
Well, first of all, I'd sit down and see what their issues are. We'd know right off the hop that it is hydro because they use massive hydro at the St. Thomas plant and the Kami plant. We have to work with the municipal governments on tax incentives, on property taxes. We have to see where they're at on that as well. But you have to give them incentives to be here. Because, as I said last night, I get letters every second week from chambers of commerce in the U.S. saying, we'll give you a tax incentive, come here, we'll help you with your building, we'll help you employ people. And up here in Ontario, we have red tape regulation, you know, taxes coming out of their ears here. We have to make sure we cut red tape, regulation, and make sure it's in an environment that companies can really grow. And that's what I think the problem is. Right now, the Liberal government, number one, doesn't have someone that's ever run a business. The premier's never run a business in her life. And we have to go in there and treat it as a business, this whole province, attract new companies. I would sit down, would negotiate hard, and make sure the key thing is make sure they employ people, because it's trickle down from there. Someone gets rid of 2,000 people in a region like this, that's a huge impact on the community.
Thank you, Doug. Christine Elliott, the question was specific closures that you would have been able to prevent, you think?
Well, I think the problem remains the same, whether it's the closure of the auto manufacturing plant in St. Thomas or Caterpillar or any of the other businesses that have closed. This is the government, the Wynn Liberals, that are anti-business. I've heard from many business owners as I've traveled across the province during this leadership campaign that they feel that they want them to close. They want businesses to close or move elsewhere. They don't seem to understand that running a profitable business is a good thing because then you can employ people. There's a huge disconnect there, and they've taken lots of actions that have made it more and more difficult for businesses to be successful. The dramatic increase in the minimum wage, the other provisions in the Bill 148, hydro rates are not attractive for anybody that needs large amounts of hydro in order to operate a factory, for example. Almost every step that they've taken has been anti-business. So we really need to level that playing field, listen to those businesses that have closed before they close, and find out what help they need and actually take action. Instead, we've had a government that's just sat idly by and seems not to care that hundreds of people are left without jobs.
Have to take our first break of the PCPO leadership debate here on The Andrew Lawton Show. Back in a moment. We are back, the Andrew Lawton Show, live debate for the PC Party of Ontario leadership candidates, joined by Tanya Granick-Allen, Doug Ford, and Christine Elliott. We spoke a little bit about some very specific areas of the economy in southwestern Ontario. Before I get to the next question, are we all in agreement, abolish the Green Energy Act?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
No objection to that? Okay.
No.
One of the plant closures that's more unique to the green energy file is that last year 340 jobs were lost when Siemens in Tillsonburg, a wind turbine production facility, shut down. Will moving away from the Green Energy Act cause more of these job losses and plant closures? And simply put, is it worth it, or will your plan cause more of that? We'll start this question with Doug Ford.
Well, you know something, the wind turbines, and my heart breaks for people losing their jobs, but the wind turbines aren't good. They just aren't good. We're paying more for energy than what it really should be costing. We're subsidizing these wind turbines. And again, you know, I apologize for the people who lost their jobs, but the money we save, hopefully we reinvest that into other industries that they will be hired. So I'm being very transparent. I'm against these wind turbines.
Christine Elliott.
Well, I'm also against the wind turbines, and I would hope that some of the companies that have been manufacturing them, like Siemens is a very large company, hopefully they could convert to some other use that would continue to employ people. But the Green Energy Act has been a disaster for Ontario. Building these wind turbines and paying the price that we have been for the power that they produce is way out of whack with normal business costs, and we've got to get them down. We need to also make sure that local municipalities can have jurisdiction over whether wind turbines can be built within their jurisdiction. That is something that the Green Energy Act completely overrode, as a result of which we have many communities with massive wind turbines that don't want them. So we need to come back to sensible energy policy in Ontario, and that requires the repeal of the Green Energy Act.
Tanya.
I currently live in Grey County, and I grew up in Toronto, but now I live in Grey County. And on my drive from Toronto home, I pass by acres and acres and acres of wind turbines. And I made it very clear, Andrew, and I said this very clearly yesterday, and I'm very, very straightforward. I'm going to rip those wind turbines out of the ground. And if they don't come out easy, I will take my tractor and I'll bulldoze them out. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because we cannot have a province. What we have in our province right now is energy poverty. People are losing money because we're subsidizing corporations who are getting rich off the backs of Ontarians, these hardworking Ontarians. And I'm putting out a notice. All those corporations right now, if you're getting fat off the back of taxpayers in Ontario, I'm putting you on notice. We will no longer do business with you. And we're going to do this in a good way. We're not going to tear up contracts the way McGuinty and Wynn Liberals do. No, that was a stupid way. We're going to do what we have legislative supremacy in this province. And what we're going to do is we're going to pass legislation which allows us to cancel these contracts. And at that point, we get to say how much if any, we will compensate those manufacturers, those corporations who are getting rich off our backs. But let me tell you one other thing. For those landowners who may have entered in a contract with those corporations and they still have, you know, say $1,000 a year they get in that revenue, I want to see them protected, and they will be protected. But for those corporations, the raping and pillaging of Ontarians will stop today, will stop the day I take down those wind turbines, and I'm going to rip them right out of the ground.
Are you okay with the job losses in the green energy manufacturing sector that would come from that plan?
Of course I'm not okay with any job losses. But that being said, we are losing jobs across the board because of these stupid contracts, because of corporations making money off Ontarians. They don't care about the taxpayers. And what do we do in the end? We're selling this this energy at a discount to our American brothers south of the border. The insanity's got to stop. We can no longer afford to live in a banana republic.
We're going to get into energy policy later on in the debate, I assure you. But in the couple of moments we have left in this segment, I'll put this to all candidates. Where do you think the future of Ontario's energy production is? What method of energy, if we can put all our eggs in one or two baskets here? And I'll put this out to the field.
Well, I come from Whitby, Oshawa area, which is a nuclear center. I grew up between Pickering and Darlington, and I think it makes sense for us to continue with nuclear energy as baseload energy and look at other supplies, hydroelectricity, others, but not this green energy with the wind turbines. It's putting businesses out of business and turning away other businesses from even looking at Ontario as a place to come.
Doug?
I agree. Nuclear energy is the way to go. It's clean. It's good. It's less expensive. And that's the way to go.
All right. We are going to move on to another topic in just a moment here, but I want to give you an opportunity very briefly. If you are going to abolish the carbon tax, as you all have said you will, where are you going to make that revenue shortfall back? We'll start on this one because you are light on time with Doug Ford.
Well, that's great. And as I've been crisscrossing the province, I've been asking people a very simple question. Out of $141 billion budget, do you think we can find 3 or 4 cents on the dollar? 4 cents is close to $6 billion. That's where we're going to find the savings. We're going to go line item by line item, going through the ministries, and find efficiencies. And also, we're going to attract new companies. When we don't have the carbon tax to burden them, that will create new revenues up to the provincial coffers. So we're going to make it environmentally friendly, first of all, but we're also going to make it attractive to companies coming to Ontario.
Tanya.
The carbon tax or the cap and trade scheme was brought in under the impression that that was to reduce behaviors and to reduce emissions. But what you're asking me in your question is, how are we going to pay for our essentials in our economy? Well, we don't need to bring in a carbon tax to pay for essentials in our economy. We don't have a revenue problem in Ontario. We have a spending problem in Ontario. Ontarians are taxed to death, and under my plan, there will be no new taxes and no increase in taxation. So while it's a laudable goal to always want to reduce emissions, and I support that fully, carbon taxation is not the solution. So what I would do is reprioritize our spending to infrastructure, to healthcare, those key deliverables that Ontarians expect us to make good on. And when we take out all these little small programs that actually do cost quite a bit, we will see that we have enough money and we just need to spend better. We have must-haves and we have wants. We need to take care of the must-haves. And then if we have money left over, we'll take care of the wants.
And Christine, last word on this.
Well, we can be both fiscally responsible and environmentally responsible without imposing a carbon tax. We've heard from members across the party who were not consulted about this in the first place, who feel very strongly against it, as well as people from regular citizens of Ontario who are not members. They are already feeling that they cannot forge ahead with another tax. They're finding it difficult right now to pay their hydro bills and buy food for their families. So we don't need to tax people more, but what we do need to do is do a value for money audit across every aspect of the Wynn Liberals budget. I think it's a little simple to say just take 4 cents off every dollar in every ministry. You can't do that in ministries like health, for example, where we've got aging baby boomers who are a huge cohort that are going to need more health care in the future. We can find those savings in other areas, though, and we do need to do that value for money audit across the board. As a former bank auditor, I know how to do that. So we need to do that. And we also need to take a look at the Liberal spending. We saw them waste $1 billion on canceled gas plants for purely political purposes. They've spent over $8 billion on e-health, and we still don't have a functioning system of electronic medical records. So there's lots that we can do, and I'm sure we will find the monies to be able to pay for our platform.
And right on time, we have to take another break. Doug, we can get you in after on the other side here, but I can get 30 seconds now, if you can give it to me in 30 seconds.
Well, I feel we can find 4% because I did it. My opponents have never done it. Matter of fact, I found over $1 billion being on the budget committee in Toronto on a $12 billion budget. Some areas you can take a little more, some a little tighter, but we'll be able to find it.
All right. When we come back, more of the PC leadership debate here on The Andrew Lawton Show. Stay tuned. We are back, the Andrew Lawton Show, PC Party of Ontario leadership debate. I wish we didn't have to take breaks, but we have to keep the lights on here. So I thank very much all those listening, tuning in on Facebook Live, and the candidates themselves for their patience on this. We spent the first block of the debate talking a lot about the economy, which I can guarantee we will revisit. I wanted to turn on to another area, though. Former PC Party leader Patrick Brown referred to social issues as divisive, and he actually said on this very radio show that he, quote, would not tolerate, unquote, members of his caucus who wish to revisit any of these social issues. As PC leader, will you take a similar approach? And if not, how will you unite the different factions of the so-called Big Blue Tent? For this question, we start with Christine Elliott.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for the question. I feel really strongly that to have a truly democratic, open, transparent party, we need to make sure that everyone who's a party member has the opportunity to speak about issues that are important to them. There we all agree on the basics of being PCs, but we don't all have the same personal issues. And I have promised that should I become the leader, I would allow a free vote in the legislature on matters of conscience so that people can be true to themselves and can also be true to the constituents who elected them. I've had the experience where I haven't wanted to vote in favor of a certain item at Queen's Park, and I've been told that either you vote in favor or go and have a coffee across the street. That is not the way to run the party. So we need to have free votes there. I also respect the conscience rights of physicians and other healthcare professionals, as well as organizations that have a religious attachment, like hospitals, palliative care facilities that don't wish to participate in things like MAID, medical assistance in dying. I think we have to protect those rights, that everyone has different ideas about some of these issues, and that it's a healthy thing to have that conversation.
Thank you, Christine Elliott. Tanya Granick-Allen.
Well, a lot of people know me as the head of an organization called Parents as First Educators, and that might be considered one of the divisive issues, although I would say it's not, because we are dead set in lobbying against the Kathleen Wynne sex ed agenda and her curriculum. And I'm very pleased that my colleagues here at the table, since I joined the race, have been improving their position. Doug, you said you'd repeal it. Great. Christine, yesterday you committed to giving parental notification so that the parents can opt out. That's great. And see, I don't think parents rallying. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to parents in Ontario, and the majority of parents think that this sex ed is a problem. So I don't see this as a divisive issue. I see it as a unitive issue. This is an opportunity for conservatives to get together, listen to the grassroots, listen to parents in Ontario, and come together and stop this insanity coming from Kathleen Wynne. But you mentioned Patrick Brown, and I have to interject there. There are a lot of things wrong with the way Patrick Brown ran things, and there were a lot of corruptive measures he took in the way he ran things, which is why I was very clear last night. I would not stand for Patrick Brown to be a candidate under my leadership. And I would like to ask the candidates again today, will you commit to now saying that Patrick Brown will not run for you because of the corruption, because of even the recent allegations, because of the past allegations? Will you take a stand against the corruption and say, no, Patrick, you will not run under me?
I think that issue has been done. I'm keeping the debate focused on issues that haven't been covered as much yet. And I want to give Doug a chance to chime in on this one.
Well, first of all, I believe everyone has the right to vote the way they believe. The only vote I'm going to require our team to vote on is the budget, to make sure that we vote together on the budget. But when it comes to the sex ed, again, I was against it even before I jumped into the race. And going back to the previous leader, you know, he kind of flip-flopped back and forth. At first he was, you know, he was against it, then he's for it. I'm against it. I believe it's up to the parents to be the first educators. Conscious rights for doctors as well. you know, it's up to them. It's not up to the government to dictate to doctors or anyone on the way they should vote or what their beliefs are. You have to respect each other's beliefs. And so they're going to have the freedom to do what they need to do on their own conscience.
You raised a question I was going to ask anyway, all of you did, and that is on conscience rights for physicians. Is it enough, in your view, to have the right for physicians to opt out of offering services, or do you think they need to also be able to opt out of referring? Because this is something that came up in a divisional court ruling in January, where that court actually ruled that they do have a duty to refer and that discrimination is justified against their beliefs. Is that something that you would pursue, that a doctor should have the right to not only say, I'm not going to provide a medically assisted death, but also I'm not going to refer anyone to that? I'll start with Christine.
Well, I think that we have to sit down and figure out how people who do want to access medical assistance in dying can get it. And I respect that a physician that does not feel comfortable doing it himself or herself may not also feel comfortable in doing the referral. But we also have to make sure that, that patients that want it can have access to it. So I think we have to figure out a way that that can be done without compromising the physician's personal beliefs and their oath that they've taken as well. So I think there's more work to be done on that.
But do you fundamentally think that a doctor should have the right to say no to a referral?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Tanya?
Yes, I fully protect the conscience rights for all healthcare workers, including doctors, but also nurses, PSWs, not only in providing services or practices that go against their conscience, but in fact also in referring. And I think part of the problem we have here is that we're focusing too much on helping people die, where we need to help focus our energy on helping people live. And that means that we have to bolster our palliative care system and make sure that people are not faced with a tough decision, that in fact if they choose to seek out and live their life out, that we help them in the comfort and with all the medical opportunities necessary.
Doug?
Well, I think we're all in agreement here. People should have the right to make decisions on their own, not the government, not the big nanny state telling doctors what they can and can't do, and even on referrals too. I totally agree with my two colleagues here.
On the note of healthcare, there was a big story in London today that actually had a somewhat happy resolution. A man named Stuart Klein, 71 years old, who was stranded in Mexico for a week because there wasn't an ICU bed available for him in Ontario. He had the money, he had the insurance coverage, no bed. This is something that an NDP member of provincial parliament, Peggy Sattler, said on my show, proves that we need more funding to address hospital bed shortages and overcrowding. I want to put to you, do you have a plan to deal with this? And do you think it is just about more money, or do you think it is also about the management of those funds? And we'll start this one with Tanya.
Sure. Well, as I've outlined in my platform while running in this very short leadership, healthcare spending is a priority of mine. I know that we have an aging population, and I know that our healthcare spending is only going to increase. Right now, it's almost roughly half of our budget. We know those costs won't go down. And, you know, as a Christian, I believe I am my brother's keeper, and we need to make sure that people are accessing services when they need it most. And usually people who are accessing medical services need them, and that's when their time of need is. So we must make sure that the money is there. And if that means that we need to sit down and look at our budget and say, okay, where can we spend? Where do we have to spend? Healthcare has to be a priority. Infrastructure and healthcare are priority areas for me in spending, and I refuse to cut anything. In fact, we must make sure there's enough money to always meet the needs of Ontarians and their healthcare.
Doug?
Well, the doctors and nurses are under full attack by this government. I've talked to numerous doctors. Well-respected Dr. Ruben Devlin is heading up my healthcare plan, and I always believe in letting the doctors and the nurses tell you how they can run things more efficiently. And I'll give you an example. Our overall budget's roughly about 38% goes to healthcare. That's $51 billion. But there's ways of making things run more efficiently. And I keep mentioning Humber River Hospital, first digital hospital in North America. They run things more efficiently. They look at lean systems. It's not always throwing money at the problem. Let's first sit down, let the doctors recommend how we can fix the problem, and as well as the nurses. And, you know, when Rob was sick, and I've mentioned the story in the past, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and we lifted him up off the bed. He slipped on the floor. Well, they only had two nurses on the floor. Now, maybe the other nurses were somewhere else, but there was only two nurses on the floor. They came in, tried to lift him up. I couldn't lift him up. We went down. I had to get two security guards
from the front hallway in the basement to come up and help me out. That's not right. That's wrong in Ontario when we're getting security guards to help out our nurses. And I'll never forget the security guards, and I'm very grateful, but to lie on the floor for it was over 10 minutes, that's humiliating for someone. And I swore that I'd never let that happen again, and we won't let it happen.
Christine.
Well, I was quite shocked, as I'm sure most Ontarians were, to hear about Mr. Klein's situation, the fact that there was no hospital close that could accept him, and he's being transferred, as I understand it, to one in St. Catharines.
Has arrived there, yes.
Yes. Well, that's good that he has arrived safely. But I do have a plan. I have worked exclusively in healthcare for the last 2 years as a patient ombudsman for Ontario, and the story of Mr. Klein is sadly similar to what I hear from many people, that hospitals are overcrowded. They're often operating at over 100% capacity, which isn't safe for patient care, infection control, and so on. But I think one of the big things that we need to do is to make sure that the hospitals have the beds available. And at any given day, up to 25% of the beds in any hospital in Ontario are occupied by frail elderly seniors who don't need to be in the hospital, but there's nowhere for them to go because they have needs that are more than can be dealt with in home care, and there are no long-term care beds for them. So that's where I think we really need to start. We have pledged in our platform to create 15,000 more long-term care beds in the first 5 years and 15,000 beds thereafter. That would allow seniors to be able to move to safe, comfortable, clean long-term care homes and then free up those beds so that we don't have that 120% capacity in hospitals anymore. But the other thing that I think we really need to do is to continue with the move to developing a patient-centered system of care. Right now, our healthcare system is really provider-focused rather than what are patients' needs and how are patients' needs being met. We need to listen to patients. We need to have them more involved in hospitals' operations, from everything from human resources to finance to operations. Let them be involved and tell healthcare providers what they need. And then we also need to listen to the healthcare providers, the doctors and nurses and other professionals in the system. They know what the systemic problems are, and they also have a really good idea about some of the solutions.
We're running a little heavy on time there, so I'll have to cut you off. Thank you very much. Do we have any other response on this, on specifics that you would take that would improve the healthcare situation?
Well, I have one area I'd actually like to highlight as the only candidate who currently lives in a rural area is I've experienced firsthand how hard it is to access medical services in the country. Forget driving further to get to a hospital. Where is the hospital? Where are the doctors? There simply aren't any. And to parlay back to the conscience rights, and I mentioned this yesterday, if we are scaring doctors from coming to Ontario because we tell them we're not going to respect their conscience rights as doctors, that's a problem. That means that we will have fewer doctors in this province who actually want to practice. I think we need to incentivize doctors to come out to the rural communities because there are a lot of folks out there, including myself, who we need care. We need to be able to know that in a time of need, I can take my kids to a doctor and not have to drive 2 hours to Toronto. Right now, you know, one of my children needs to see a specialist. My option is going 2 hours one way or 2 hours the other. And you have to rearrange your whole life just to make sure you get to that specialist. And look, I understand not all specialists will be accessible everywhere, but even to get a general practitioner, my goodness, folks, we cannot ignore, like, it's all nice to talk about the big hospitals in Toronto, but what about the folks in the rural communities? Where are my doctors?
Doug?
Well, when I was traveling across Ontario, came upon Peterborough, met the people there, found out that there's 7,000 people in Peterborough that don't have a physician. That's only an hour and a bit away. So we have to give doctors incentives for the rural areas. And as I've said, even if, you know, the province has to pitch in and build them a little medical office, we need all residents of Ontario, even in the rural areas, to make sure they have a physician. And just an hour away, an hour and a bit, Peterborough, there's 7,000 patients that don't even have a physician.
Thank you, Doug Ford. We have to take a break. We'll be back and shift our gears to education in just a moment on the Andrew Lawton Show PC Leadership Debate. Stay tuned. Welcome back. PC Leadership Debate here on the Andrew Lawton Show, moving right along into education. And this is one of these issues that is of particular concern to Southwestern Ontario. The PC Party currently supports a moratorium on rural school closures, including a review of schools that are currently slated for closure with preference to consider local community input. Before I go on, anyone in disagreement with that policy? Are we all supporting that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
The question is then, how do you, as fiscal conservatives, rationalize keeping under-capacity schools open when consolidation could save money? We'll start with Doug.
Well, first of all, let's start about the education system. When I'm premier, I'll be going through the curricular documents of every single area and make sure that we review them. And one example is half of our grade 6 students, when it comes to math, are at the provincial standards. We should be at the highest percentile in the entire world. The Liberals automatically, they want to throw $60 million at it. Well, that hasn't changed. Still, half haven't hit the provincial standards. When it came to the college strikes, there was 500,000 students left out for 5 weeks. That was the longest strike in Ontario's history. And, Andrew, 26,000 of them never returned. So we have to make sure that we focus on the students. And when it comes to saving costs in the government or the education system, you know, there's a lot of duplication. We have to start focusing on procurement practices, purchasing, making sure that there's joint purchasing. When we have the separate school board and the public school board purchasing paper, I'm using that as an example, paper. Why aren't we combining that purchasing together to lower the cost? Why do we have two, as I said last night in the debate, two Taj Mahals on Highway 10 and the 401? One separate school board, one public school board. We have layers and layers of management. We need to put teachers back in the classrooms, reduce classroom sizes, and get rid of all the layers of people at the school board.
Would you care to address rural schools at all, which was the question?
Yeah, I think if there's a school and it doesn't have full capacity, we have to visit it. It doesn't make sense if, you know, you have certain rural schools that have 40 students in it.
So that's
you
not
have to
supporting
make it
the standing
well, it's
PC
not,
party.
It's not, not 100%, but it's difficult. How do you justify 100% keeping a school open that has 40 or 50 students in? You know, it's reality. It's reality, but you have to take into consideration the rural area. How far is the other school? It's not an easy answer to answer that, you know, if there's two schools apart 50 miles, that's a little tougher than two schools apart 2 miles or 5 miles.
We'll go to Christine next.
Well, I would support the moratorium on school closures in rural areas, as we have in our platform, because in many small rural communities, the school is the community hub. So it's not just a school, but it's the center for so many other activities. And when you look at what's in the best interest of children, to have them being bused for an hour and a half a day, a 5- or 6-year-old, that's not right. That's not really looking at the child's best interests. But I think the way you deal with it when you have a school with declining enrollment is take a look at other uses to which it could be put. So you need to involve not just the Ministry of Education, but perhaps Health, Community and Social Services, maybe even the Attorney General's Office for Justice-related issues, and have them work together so that the income can be there and the revenue can be generated and the school can become a multi-purpose building. But part of that is the way government does business, and government is very siloed even within ministries. There's silos within ministries. What I would want to do as leader of the party and ultimately premier is to make sure that the ministries work together on some of these issues. This isn't the only one. Mental health and addictions is another one. Developmental services is another one, where it's not just one ministry that's responsible. We need to change the way government operates too.
Tanya.
Education is one of the core deliverables. People expect Ontario government to deliver education. And so we must deliver that education where people are. I am from the rural community. Kids sit on buses for an hour just to go to their local school. And now people are suggesting they shut down that school. It's not going to happen. If we need to, we will rethink the way we deliver education in rural areas when there where there is under enrollment. Maybe we have to get back to a different kind of model that will encompass different grades closer together, and that's fine. At the end of the day, though, we have when we talk about education, it always must come down to parental choice. Shutting down school boards, shutting down schools, that eliminates parental choice in education. And I'm sorry, this is not acceptable. Parents must have the option to send their children, have them educated where and how they can. And I know that's a challenge in rural communities, but I'm 100% on supportive of making sure that we have as many schools as possible open in rural areas to meet the needs of children where they are. I don't want to see children spending extra time on a school bus. You know, in Toronto or in these big cities, they don't have to commute as far. Their parents drive them 5 minutes or they go for, you know, a 10-minute walk. But in the rural communities, these kids are tired. They're sitting on these buses a long time, and to increase that would just be a scandal. So we need to rethink the way we're delivering education so that parental choice is protected and that kids can spend more time with their family at the end of the day.
Would anyone revisit seniority-based hiring for teachers, Regulation 274? No?
I'm not so familiar with that. I'm sorry. Okay. I can't speak to it.
Seniority-based hiring, not anyone on the panel revisiting that. We do have to take one final break into our final half hour here. When we come back, lots more of the Andrew Lawton Show debate with PC Party of Ontario leadership candidates. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Andrew Lawton Show debate, kicking off our third and final half hour of the program, joined in the AM 980 Great Hall with Tanya Granick-Allen, Christine Elliott, and Doug Ford. I wanted to move on to another education question. This one touches post-secondary education. We are right now about an hour away from Laurier University, which, as I'm sure you all know, last year was the home of one of the more egregious examples of people that believe universities don't have a safe haven for free debate and open debate. The federal conservative leadership race saw Andrew Scheer actually put forward a policy that he said if a university doesn't protect free speech, he'd revisit federal funding. Well, universities are mostly provincially funded. Would you support a similar policy provincially? Or if not, do you think there is a necessity to tackle in this area free speech on campus? We start with Christine Elliott.
Well, I think there is a concern on many university campuses where people don't feel that they can freely express their views. And if you can't at university, you wonder where really can you? I'm not sure that I would take it to the extent of cutting off funding, but I certainly would want to address it, have a conversation with the presidents and with students and find out what the specific concerns are and work on it that way. But there is a problem on both universities and college campuses, and I think we need to make it a place where students can feel free to express their views.
Tanya.
Well, I had the privilege and honor of interviewing Dr. Jordan Peterson in his home last year on the sex ed issue and a whole host of other issues, and I guess he sort of inspired me. His words inspire many people, but inspired me to kind of use my voice and use my freedom of expression to bring a lot of these issues to the forefront, and that's why I'm running. Obviously, freedom of expression is a protected charter right. I would expect universities that receive funding, or even the ones that don't, to respect the Charter of Rights. So in a democracy, nothing is more important than that free exchange of ideas. We do not need political correctness stifling freedom of speech, which we have now. So we don't need that. We don't need the government moderating and the exchange of ideas, especially in a place, in an academic setting like the university campuses. I mean, that's where, I remember when I was at Western many years ago, 15 years ago, you know, debating after philosophy class issues of like moral relativism or my policies on this and that. And some of those ideas stayed with me, but that's how I got to hash out my beliefs and why I believed what I did and work through those doubts and work through and research. We need the open exchange of ideas. So I would support any measure that protects the charter right of freedom of speech, especially on university campuses.
Including looking at funding if they don't.
That's something we could investigate, okay. But I, like every citizen, whether they're in university or not, needs to uphold our right to freedom of speech, period.
Thank you. Doug Ford.
Well, funny you say Laurier. One of my daughters is there right now. My other two daughters went, so I've heard this issue around the dinner table. But where better to have freedom of speech but in the universities, in the colleges? Mm-hmm. To answer your question, Andrew, about the funding, I wouldn't put the gun to their head. I think we could sit down, discuss it, but I wouldn't go as far as cutting off the funding. But everyone should have the freedom of speech, no matter if it's in college, universities, or anywhere else, as long as long as it's not a racist speech or attack speech, but open conversations, freedom of speech, 100%. I agree 100%. And a lot of times they get shut down. Matter of fact, a lot of times they do.
I wanted to turn back to an issue that has been really central to political discussions in London and area. The province has committed $170 million to a bus rapid transit project in London that is in total worth more than $500 million. Billions have been spent on similar projects in other cities. For rural Ontarians, though, they're paying into that tax pie. They're not seeing a direct benefit from a lot of these projects. And I'm wondering what you will do to guarantee value for money for rural Ontarians and also people in cities that don't know if this is something that is right for them or their community. We'll start with Tanya.
Well, obviously, I mean, I've rode the bus in London many times. I don't know if it still happens, but at Western, when you enrolled, you get a free bus pass. So that bus pass took me many places when I was here. So I'm happy to see that London is looking in ways to improve their busing and their transportation with a rapid transit line. And I support that. And if the province can chip in, great. Obviously, there's a tax base in London, and they have to look to their tax base to see what the areas of spending are for them. In terms of the rural communities, yeah, I mean, I live in the rural community. I get it. I do not use public transit. I use it all the time in Toronto, all the time with four kids in tow, taking that stroller, climbing downstairs because the escalators weren't working or there wasn't one. So I appreciate the importance of mass transit in large urban centers. I think we need to look at infrastructure and how infrastructure relates to rural communities. So that means making sure our roads are in shape. Obviously, we don't have a bus system where I live. There's no need for one. So we need to also make sure money is being allocated to the maintenance of roads and to those services in rural communities.
Doug.
Well, I love transportation. I love infrastructure. That's where we should be reallocating money. Maybe the $469 million for credits that were given to California and were given to Quebec, that's where we reinvest the $469 million into roads infrastructure. And as for London, you know, the Liberal government's been talking about it, but they aren't doing anything. They aren't doing anything. This is a town of, and correct me if I'm wrong, probably close to 400,000 people. That's a fair-sized town.
The government has committed $170 million.
But get it moving. Stop talking about it. I've seen how they try to work with transportation in Toronto. They talk, but they don't do anything. Let's move forward on it, and let's provide proper transportation.
Christine.
Well, the bus rapid transit system sounds like a very promising idea. I understand that the details are still being finalized. It's being presented, I think, April 9th for a final decision. And I think that London is to be commended for looking at expanding transit systems in the way that you can. But what I also hear from people as I've been traveling across the province, especially in the north and in rural areas, that Toronto, for example, gets more money than they should for expansion of subways and GO trains and so on. But there are huge infrastructure deficits in some smaller communities. And I've heard from mayors and heads of government as I've been traveling around. And what they're saying is there needs to be some way for municipalities to be able to do things like even fixing potholes, building roads, building bridges and so on, that they're not getting that assistance from the provincial government. And so some of them are having to add on money to property taxes. That's not the way to do it. People are already paying very high property taxes. But I think that the government of Ontario needs to make sure that every community in the province gets the infrastructure money that they need in order to complete the work that has to be done for the safety of the people that live in their communities.
What about intermunicipal projects like high-speed rail? This is one where Kathleen Wynne has kind of had in a perpetual holding pattern this idea of maybe we'll have a bidding process for an environmental assessment that might tell us something. This would be connecting Windsor to Toronto. Is this something you want to proceed with?
If the research comes out and the reports come out, say that we can, and a feasibility study comes out in the positive, then absolutely. It is a huge corridor, and I think if we connect those corridors together, those cities, then we can improve the local economy and also the economy at large. Let people be able to freely, to be able to transport themselves from one city to the other, and that will bring jobs back, obviously, in the creation of that transportation link and hub. But not only that, more businesses would be interested in investing in southwestern Ontario, knowing that their employees can get to and from work in the fashion that they like.
Doug.
I love high-speed rail. I really do. But you have to let the market dictate. You're going to spend billions and billions of dollars if there isn't a demand there. But I take a different approach, too. Build it, they will come. It also expands the opportunity for employment for people in the rural areas. Rather, if you're living a couple hours out of Toronto and you can get downtown in Toronto with high-speed rail in 40 minutes, I can't even get from Etobicoke downtown in less than an hour. It's an hour and 10 minutes. I can fly to our plant in Chicago in 55 minutes. So I think it expands the opportunity for growth, for jobs, for people in the rural areas. That's what they want. They want jobs. But if they're 2 hours out, you know, it doesn't make, you know, they can't find jobs. Bring them into Toronto. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity if you build high-speed rail. I would like to extend it into the U.S., have a partnership with some of the southern states, because there's so many people that go to New York, they go to Chicago. Let's expand it and connect it into the U.S. as well.
Thank you, Doug. Christine.
High-speed rail is a very good idea. I believe the business case is very clear that we need to connect southwestern Ontario with Toronto for movement of people, but also movement of people working on businesses. We want to have that connection. I think that's really critical, especially with the hubs that are being created around Kitchener-Waterloo. That's something that is going to create employment for people in the future. I think there is a strong case for it. I would definitely want to proceed with the environmental assessment at this point.
Thanks very much. We have to take a break in just a moment here, but if we can keep our answers to 30 seconds each, you're elected leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario. Your government is formed. You're the premier. What is the first major piece of legislation you'd tackle, either you putting something forward or perhaps repealing something from the current era? We'll start with Doug.
Well, that's a good question. I'll tell you what I would do. I'd look at the finances. That's the first thing I would do. It's see exactly where we stand.
First piece of legislation, though.
First piece of legislation, and make sure that we cut the tax rate. That's what we need to do. The minimum wage, it jumped from, let's say, $12 up to $14. I would put a 0% tax on anyone earning under $30,000. Okay. It would make sure that
I want to give everyone a chance to get an answer before the break.
Thank seconds, you, though, I apologize. Doug.
All right, Christine.
Well, cutting the tax rate would be obviously a priority, but also repealing the Green Energy Act, I think, because it's been the cause of many of the problems we see in our communities and the outrageous hydro bills that are hurting both consumers and businesses. So we need to attract businesses to Ontario. Reasonable hydro rates are necessary, so Green Energy Act.
Okay,
gone.
Thank you. And Tanya?
Repeal the sex ed of Kathleen Wynne. Get rid of the cap and trade, no carbon tax, and passing legislation that will allow me to rip those wind turbines out of the ground.
All right. Thanks very much. We have to take our final break of the debate. We'll be back to close things out in just a moment here on The Andrew Lawton Show. Stay tuned. We are back. The final segment of the PC Party of Ontario leadership debate here on 980 CFPL. Running out of time very quickly, so we'll get right into the next segment here. And this is a question on the labor market in Ontario, and specifically one of the fastest growing line items of the provincial budget is the cost of public sector pensions. These defined benefit plans have billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities. Ontario taxpayers, many of whom don't have pensions themselves, are on the hook for these. Do you think public sector pensions are excessive or in need of some kind of reform? We'll start with Christine.
Well, I think that the pensions of yesterday we can't afford anymore, and I think we do need some kind of revision. People used to go to work and they'd stay at work for the same employer for all of their lives. That's not the status now. People change careers quite often, and so we want to make sure that people can provide for their retirement. There's other options, though, than the pension plans that we've currently had. So I think that we even need to look at some of the things in auto manufacturing, for example. Companies like General Motors are at a competitive disadvantage in many respects with some of the other car companies because they have those legacy items, those big pensions and so on. The Ontario government is the same. So I think we really need to have a serious look at it because it is a big liability that most people don't realize.
Tanya.
I think going forward, we need to revisit very carefully how we fund things in this province. And with respect to pensions, I agree. I mean, this is a huge liability. Obviously, decisions were made in the past, and it's hard to revisit those without harming people's savings that they've made, savings and contributions for the retirement. That being said, as I said, going forward, I think we need to be very clear in what we're doing, because at the end of the day, we must always respect the taxpayer and the Ontarian, because these salaries are being paid for by Ontarians, working families here in Ontario. So if we... we must always understand that any dollar we dole out, be it to a wind turbine or to somebody's salary working for the government, is this an essential? Because this is somebody, this is taking a dollar off somebody's allowance or somebody's budget for their food or for their housing or for their mortgage. So we have to be very responsible going forward.
Doug.
Moving forward, I don't want to hurt the people that have been paying into this, but moving forward, we definitely have to... look at the pensions. The unfunded pensions are killing the country. It's actually killing a lot of states in the U.S. as well. In the city of Toronto, we had $1 billion of unfunded pensions. We had to pay that down $100 million a year. We can't afford it. You know, we can't have, you know, more people taking out than we have putting in. It's very simple math. So moving forward, I'd definitely go through the pension plans with a microscope.
In the private sector, we also, of course, have the Bill 148 reforms that, in addition to a graduated minimum wage increase, also included a number of other changes, many of which were criticized by business groups in Ontario. Do you intend to change any parts of Bill 148 when you take office as Premier, if that is what's in your future? Christine?
Yes. First of all, I wouldn't proceed with the additional $1 an hour increase that's scheduled for next year to move the minimum wage from $14 to $15. We've heard from business owners across the province that that was too large an increase, the increase to $14, that they couldn't absorb it. And as a result, it's hurting the people it was meant to help. People are being laid off or having their hours cut. I would want to make sure that we could gradually bring in the increase. We do want to, of course, increase the minimum wage, but I'd like to speak to business owners and perhaps bring it in 25 cents an hour over 4 years, something like that, whatever they can absorb and still manage to keep their employees on the payroll. There are other provisions of Bill 148 I'd want to take a look at as well, where people who are maybe only working one day a week get full benefits that they didn't receive before. That's not something that I think people would expect as employees, and something that business owners are finding it really, really hard to cope with.
Tanya.
I'm the daughter of immigrants. Both my parents came here in the 60s, and my father ran a small construction company. So I understand that I too actually run a small consulting company, small business rather. So I appreciate firsthand how this kind of minimum wage increase in the radical way and it was implemented, how it does hinder small businesses, which are the backbone for Ontario's economy. So I think the way it was implemented was awful. We're seeing the results now, and studies come out in the coming months. We will see truly firsthand. I think while some employees have benefited, and I'm happy to have that they're making more money, but at the end of the day, is their take-home pay actually greater when their hours are being cut just so that these small businesses can absorb this radical leap? So I would hold off on doing that proposed next $1 increase in January so that we can really consult with small businesses. I've said this very clearly throughout this campaign. We make bad policy when we don't talk to the grassroots of this province. When conservatives make policy on the fly, we're not successful. We have to go back to our principles and go back to our values, that we must consult with the grassroots, and that includes small businesses in Ontario.
Doug.
Well, let's be very clear. This is vote buying from the Liberals. Make no mistake about it. You know, they jumped the minimum wage up 30-some-odd percent. The businesses, the impact on the businesses, they can't handle it. But the people making minimum wage, it all breaks our heart. It's tough to work at minimum wage. I wouldn't increase it up to $15. What I said earlier on, I'm going to make sure they have a 0% tax on anyone earning under $30,000. That actually puts roughly about $160 in their pocket. So they're going to leave the back of their factory, their office, the restaurant with $160 more in their pocket. What Kathleen Wynne did is not just hurt them economically because prices are going up, but the only one making the money on it is Kathleen Wynne. You know, they're paying more tax. I take a different approach. I want to put more money into their pocket opposed to taxing them more. And people don't realize the person that is making now $14, the person that was making $14 now wants $16, the person making $16 wants $18. So you know, it just kills a lot of businesses.
The time has flown by. We now go to our candidates for closing statements. They are limited to 60 seconds, and we'll go in the reverse order from where we started. So the first of the closing statements goes to Christine Elliott.
Well, thank you. All of us here today want to win the next election. We want a progressive, conservative majority government. But I think the reality is that Ontario needs us to win. We cannot afford four more years of the win Liberals. And the unusual part of this leadership campaign is the fact that it's being held just about 100 days in advance of a general election in Ontario, a general election that is going to be very stressful, lots of issues there. It's going to be difficult for whoever is running the party to move forward. We need someone with experience, someone who has knowledge of Queen's Park and is ready to take over on day one, on March 11th, is ready to go. And I'm in this candidate leadership search because I believe that I'm the only candidate that does have that experience. I've been elected four times. I've served for 9 years at Queen's Park. I understand how Queen's Park operates, but I've also had the opportunity to travel the province to understand every part of the province and what the issues are. I'm ready to take on Kathleen Wynne and win a progressive conservative majority.
We'll have to end it there. Thank you, Christine. Doug.
Well, my friends, this is the most critical election in Ontario's history. And we're going to have a choice to make. We can either elect someone that is more liberal-minded, because I think we can all win, more liberal-minded, or you can elect someone that believes in lowering taxes with a proven track record. I'm the only one with a proven track record of actually governing and going down there and saving $1 billion. Someone that's going to take on the establishment, the political elites, that have been running this province for years. I will take on the liberal media, the political elites. We're going to clean house. I've always said Queen's Park is politically corrupt from top to bottom. We need someone to go in and straighten out the problems in our own party. I'm the only one that doesn't have all the political insiders, political establishment that surrounded them. I'm going to make sure I speak for the grassroots people. When I'm premier, I will make sure there's a new day that's dawned in Ontario. One of growth and prosperity. Prosperity this province has never seen
before. Thank you, Doug Ford. We'll go to the last word with Tanya.
Thanks, Andrew. From the beginning of this campaign, I said I would be a very clear and strong voice. And I think as people have heard over the last few weeks, I have done just that. And I'm a strong voice for grassroots conservatives across this province who've been shut out by our own party. But we're going to bring those voices back. I've said it very clearly. I will not allow Patrick Brown to run under me. My two colleagues said that they're okay with that. That's not going to happen to me. I refuse to allow corruption back into this party. And we're going to get rid of that. And we're going to move on from there. I have spent the last few years meeting with the grassroots of Ontario, consulting with parents who are horrified about the Wynne sex ed, who are horrified about the way this province is being run, who want just to keep a few more dollars instead of paying money to large corporations. So let's make those hard decisions. I'm capable of making those hard decisions. And I ask for your support put me at the top of your ballot.
Thank you, Tanya Granick-Allen. Thank you to all candidates, Christine Elliott, Doug Ford, Tanya Granick-Allen, all of our viewers at home, people that submitted their questions. The race is on. And I know that there have been some issues that have been raised, people that have not yet gotten their letter. Call the party. The PC party has been very equivocal about this, or unequivocal. Call them. Do your work there. Try, if you're a member, to make sure you get your vote in. We have to thank all of the candidates again for all of their time. Appreciate it. All right, and that wraps it up for me. This is the Andrew Lawton Show on 980 CFPL. Thank you, God bless, and good day, London.